We're doomed, we're saved.
The BioRevolution Podcast.
Your hosts, Luise von Stechow
and Andreas Horchler. So this time we call the episode New Biotechnologies Revolution or Evolution. And there might be some things where maybe I will not agree, because I'm so convinced that it has to be something bottom-up, like a social development, changing the world. There is a bio-revolution, I'm convinced of that, but the social element is somewhat lacking, and it's a top-down thing that's going on. But we will discuss that, and as always, we start with quotes, I think, right?
Yes. Let's start with a quote from Thomas Kuhn, who was a physicist turned historian, and he wrote actually one of the most influential books on the history of science or on scientific theory, which is called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And he kind of coined the term scientific revolutions, and also a term that we're using all the time, not only in biotechnology, but I think in any tech field, which is the paradigm shift. So paradigm shift is something that people really like to say.
Sounds a lot like marketing lingo.
A little bit, yeah, and like this tech lingo. So now we have this new thing, and now the paradigm shifts. But this was the guy who actually came up with the theories around it, and some of the things that he postulated were kind of, or feel like commonplace today, but they were revolutionary and also highly controversial back in the day. So he says scientists have no way to compare concepts on either side of a scientific revolution. And I think that's what we want to dig in today. Is the biorevolution actually something that we would consider a revolution?
Exactly. And I think you brought a second one as well, from a more popular source, I might say.
Yeah. So that's from Yuval Noah Harari. I have many quotes from him.
Yeah. And for good reason.
Yeah, for good reason. I think, I mean, he just thinks about the things that we talk about. He was doing an interview with Stephen Colbert, and there he said that it's the first time in human history no one has any idea how the future will look like in 20 years. And he actually added to that, every generation thinks that, but this time it's true.
And why that is true, and why we might approach the term revolution, and why, after all, it might fit, we talk about that now. But the groundworks, where do we come from? How would you summarize the recent development and why we might coin revolution as a term for what's going on?
So, I mean, we also, our podcast, right, that we have now for almost 2 years is called the BioRevolution Podcast. And I think I kind of took the term from, shame on me, a McKinsey report. So it was a McKinsey report from 2020. No shame involved, of course, but I think it's like not maybe the final source of truth. But this report I really liked, because they outline this idea that we now have a number of technologies at our hands within the field of the biosciences, many of them pertaining to changing humans in different ways, but also, of course, any other living organism. And I mean, this was at the high time of the pandemic, where we got the feeling on the one hand how biology can overpower us and change the way we live in a very transformative way. No one is allowed to leave the house anymore. Everyone works from home, all these changes. But at the same time, we also noticed how fast and good we are at fighting back with this like super fast vaccine development that then gave us this moment of hope and of, now we can resume. I mean, for me, it was really like I was very emotional when I learned that this vaccine worked in the first tests, because for me, it was really this moment, we actually can get back to life. And I mean, for me, a revolution, and I think we'll dive into this term a little bit deeper in a second. And I think, I mean, we're both not social scientists, so I think there are probably like very deep thoughts on what it means, but I think we can still put some meat to the term and think about what it actually means. And I think a revolution is something that profoundly changes the way that we live. That for me would qualify as a revolution, that really changes the way that humans live. And it has different sources. And if a new biotechnology is the source, then that might be a biorevolution.
To say that the vaccine development was something that was revolutionary is a fair deal, I guess, because we know that the development of a new drug is like 10, 12 years down the road, and we were dealing with a couple of months.
Yeah, less than a year. Yeah. Yeah. And this is revolutionary. This is not per se a revolution. I would agree, because I mean, it builds on other revolutions. But to give two examples actually from the medical field, the first development of vaccines, I would say, and the development of antibiotics could be seen as a revolution because it prevented or made it possible to treat many microbial, bacterial diseases, but also prevent viral diseases, actually eradicating, for example, smallpox, which was really detrimental. By that, changed the way we live.
True.
Quite profoundly, because back in the days, I mean, of course, there's also more sanitary living conditions. I have to add that on top. But the reduction of infectious disease is the main reason why the lifespan almost doubled within a century. And of course, this also means that we change the way we live quite profoundly. Of course, the average of life changed, not that everyone gets much older, but it also means that, I mean, for example, per family would have fewer children, much fewer children than you used to have, because before, I mean, that was basically the...
As many as possible.
As many as possible to sustain, but that's not necessary anymore. So this means there is some revolution in this. At the same time, I mean, it also paved the way for many other medical advances, for example, that you can transplant organs without antibiotics, that would not be possible.
Absolutely.
Or many advanced cancer treatments that suppress your immune system. Also there, I mean, having antibiotics, it's really, yeah. So that for me would kind of count as revolutionary.
Yeah, I'm 100% fine with the term revolutionary. But is it a revolution? Or I think we approach the topic a little bit maybe by addressing the ingredients of a revolution. And of course, there's one that's crystal clear, that's a specific need that we start with, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, I mean, what we classically would call revolutions. So, for example, the French Revolution, the American Revolution, the Communist Revolution, but also things that are more, let's say, feel a bit more subtle, but still have profound changes. For example, the movement for women's rights, for civil rights, for having more eco-friendly policies. All these originate from a need, which is that one part of the population or a large part of the population is not treated well enough or is misaligned with the system that they live in. So not having the same rights for everyone, economic disparities, so some people having a lot more money than others. And if this reaches a tipping point where people are getting actually very unhappy, this can cause a revolution that usually transpires in, for example, protests, sometimes even violent ones, or an overthrow of current political system.
That, of course, holds true for the American Revolution, for the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and a total change of a social system. To me, there's quite a difference to the biorevolution, again, because, of course, the beneficiaries of those developments, like antibiotics, for instance, are basically everyone, but the beginning of the development is a top-down kind of thing because there are scientists experimenting and maybe in the case of antibiotics, finding things out by chance, which so often happens.
Serendipity, yeah.
Exactly. But still, they're in a lab. They're not in the, for instance, early industrialized phase of this planet where evil is done and people are treated really bad and a huge social movement gets underway.
Yeah, but I would slightly disagree to
okay,
that because
that's good.
I think that, yes, I mean, it's top down in a sense that there must be research funding, but the way this funding is distributed sometimes also is changed in a bottom-up way. So one example I would say, which also was really revolutionary, was finding treatments for HIV, which has revolutionized for many people living with HIV the condition, absolutely, from being a clear death sentence to something that might be livable. And even, I mean, depending on how good the drugs work for you, quite okay life. So that said, I mean, this also In the beginning, there was a huge stigma surrounding the disease, and there was not a lot of funds going towards the research. But then, I mean, there was like a lot of money dedicated through advocacy, and researchers found something that works. And I think this is also a lot of what we talk about on this podcast is inequality within healthcare systems. And I mean, this is a huge deal, of course, having on the one hand, and I mean, we said it many times, you cannot weigh the value of a life. So every life is as valuable, but there is also economics in the play. And there are treatments for rare diseases in the Western world that cost $4 million per shot. And there are no malaria treatments that would cost, I don't know, for
Sub-Sahara.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is,
I think the HIV example is very, very good, because as you said, that going through my mind were cases like the movie Philadelphia, for instance, or the case of Freddie Mercury, Queen. Yeah. You know, there was so much stigma in that. And we can, I think, with good reason, construct that today in 2024, the stigma is not present anymore. And it is not that present anymore because the drug development.
Exactly.
And this is revolutionary again. You get me on your side a little bit, because that's revolution.
Let me give you another drug that's revolutionary and that actually really changed the way that we live, which is anti-contraceptives. So having, as we call it, the anti-baby pill, I think that for Americans, that's very funny.
Yes, it is.
Well, depends on which side of the political curtain you are. Some people probably don't find it funny, but damnable. But yeah, I mean, this is a revolution, right? It's a revolution because you, as a woman, can choose if you want children or not.
And the same is half of the world population.
Exactly. Yep, and the same is, again, a little bit true for, I mean, this HIV treatments that, again, I mean, there was this moment, this window of sexual freedom that was kind of closed by the epidemic, because it meant, I mean, this freedom can cost you your life. And to reverse that, I think that is revolutionary. And this is also something that we saw with COVID, that suddenly, I mean, your life can change quite drastically through viruses, and reversing that.
So, where would you say are the origins and the expressions of the biorevolution and this scientific revolution? Where are the sources? Because people have always developed and found out things, in essence, many times by chance, as we pointed out already. Where would you say where were turning points beyond COVID, HIV, and antibiotics?
When we approach it more from the viewpoint of, is it a scientific revolution? I mean, I can already give my two cents. I don't think it's a scientific revolution, not in the sense that Kuhn described, because this would mean a paradigm shift. And the paradigm shift is something from changing from Ptolemaic to Copernican
worldview
or like universe view. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, are we at the center or maybe just
somewhere.
The same, I mean, what really was revolutionary in the biosciences was Darwin. So that's a scientific revolution that changes the way we actually put our place. Not now, okay, we lost our center of the universe, but now we lose our center of creation, basically. Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, what he describes there is that you have this period of normal science where everyone aligns with a paradigm, or kind of the research community agreed, this is our paradigm. We all find corroborating evidence, and sometimes we find anomalies. And if those accumulate too much, then there might be a scientific revolution that changes the picture. I do not think for the biorevolution that this is true, because we have a lot of new technologies at our hands, but they all align to the picture that we have of biology. We find new molecules all the time, smaller and smaller, or different regulators. For example, this whole field of RNA biology, microRNA is one topic that were discovered when I was studying.
So we
find new things, but they don't overthrow the system at the current stage. They all fit within the system. They just allow us to change the system. So from that perspective, I would not say that it's a scientific revolution. The origins are really at the technology side or at the discovery side. So, I mean, understanding DNA has been massive, of course. understanding the code of DNA, understanding how we can change this code. So all the around Paul Berg in the 70s having all this genetic engineering, this possibility to change the code at will, which revolutionized in a sense the way that drugs can be made and now allows gene therapies and gene editing therapies that we talked about quite a bit. So this is very groundbreaking technologies that completely align with what we knew about biology, but they allow us to change the rules. Other things I think come from other fields having technological possibilities. Artificial intelligence really, I think, makes a huge difference. Having neuroprosthetics, so having implants that change our capacities, there are really exciting and slightly scary developments along those lines. Also, those have transformative potential, but they still align with how we think our biology works. I would say there's one frontier where we do not know that well how it works, and this is our brains. And we might see a real scientific revolution once we understand how, I mean, there are many people who study the way that consciousness works. And I think there is still a lot of potential to really change the paradigm and a lot of uncertainty. But when it really comes to the basics, so life happens in cells. We have DNA that has the same code. Biological systems communicate, they divide, all these things. There, I don't see a paradigm shift.
I would try to argue, wouldn't we find, and I'm going to put that real simplistic, wouldn't we find in the way we trust data, and this is a process that's fairly new, I would say, that we have such a huge impact of data in what we're doing scientifically and in real life. So the analogy would be for me that basically, a person without a cell phone isn't a human being anymore, because you don't need to know stuff anymore. You don't need to know your way around. You Google it. You have Google Maps. You know, you're missing some, you know, biographical node, and you just punch in stuff you're searching for wherever you are. Impossible, like 10, 15, 20 years ago. I would argue that this in itself, and if I transpose this to science and the usage of data and the trusting we put into data at that point, that this is pretty revolutionary and a paradigm shift in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, to an extent, maybe. I would say there is this strange term flying around of the post-fact era that we're in, so that we're not relying on facts anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Which was kind of coined around this alternative fact Donald Trump kind of thing. I think that this has always been true. There have always been many sources of information, and we chose which ones to believe. I think that we fooled ourselves into thinking that we believe the data more nowadays because we have more data available. But in the end, I think we trust very much our echo chambers, so we trust the information that corroborates what we anyways believe. And this is something I think that also really applies to what Kuhn, and I think this is one very interesting aspect of this book, describes. Scientists really work within their paradigm, and when they shift it, this might not be the case because they have a better explanation, but maybe it's kind of a groupthink. So it's more the shift in the environment that scientists work in, that they find a different explanation for how the world works.
Extremely interesting, yes.
Which might not be because we now understand it better, just that we all together in this group decided we have a different explanation now. And this is, I had to think very much about the debate between science and creationism, which, I mean, this is a different paradigm. And there are, I mean, creationist universities. Of course, you can never fully explain the world within your paradigm. So who knows? Maybe they're right. I'm very convinced they're not. But
me too.
It can be that their dystopian change comes about in 10 years or so. Mm-hmm. I just rewatched The Handmaid's Tale. And suddenly we all have to believe something that we didn't believe in. Mm-hmm. And this takes a few generations. And then you're convinced.
Right. with data again and the growing role, rapidly growing role of AI, for instance. We start, that's my conviction at the moment at least, we start to believe very strongly in what data-driven algorithmic worlds tell us.
Yeah, and they don't only tell us because they influence us, of course. We have Spotify that tells us which music to listen to, and we have Netflix that tells us you might also like, and we have Instagram that tells us, doesn't tell us anything, but if you watch three videos of cats, it knows, oh, she might like cats.
And you're then addicted. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Okay, we can agree to disagree that this is not yet a paradigm shift, as Kuhn coined it. Mm. But at least I think we can agree that this is something, as we speak, going on that's quite revolutionary.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, I wanted to make the point in the very beginning, but I didn't, when you did the intro, to say there's one word to refute the theory that revolutions have to be bottom up. And I would say this is the word is iPhone, because it was given to us by a big tech company, but it massively changed, it revolutionized the way that we live. It means that we, if you take the metro in the morning, you will never make eye contact with anyone ever again,
anymore.
Because everyone looks on their phones. We communicate in a completely different way, and we cannot focus on other sources. So I just read an article that explained that was about Netflix, that they are now debating that it cannot go too deep because it needs to be second screenable. So assuming that if you watch a series at the same time, you will also look at your phone so that
your timeline and Instagram.
You can divide your attentions between your two screens. I actually always did that. I was always looking at something else while I always watched TV and read at the same time, which is really stupid because it just means that you cannot focus on anything. But now this is mainstream. But
you were a front runner.
Yeah, definitely.
With books and watching TV.
Front runner of slight ADHD. But this means, I think, in the long run, and it might already be starting, this will also change our brains quite drastically. And it changes definitely, and I think this is something that almost anyone can testify, it changes our attention spans. It makes it, because we're taught or we're trained to consume bite-sized content, and having content that's longer and more complicated, reading long articles, it becomes really almost impossible for many people. And this is a, for me, I would say this is a revolutionary change. And there is this element of being slightly, I mean, this is also a question of neuroprosthetic that sometimes raised, that people say we are already cyborgs because we're so glued to our phones.
Yeah. And the difference is not that big anymore if there's an implant or if I hold it in my hand.
I mean, it's an extension of our lives. And what you just said, like we get all our information immediately from our phone instead of when I was a kid, we had debates and then no one knew the answer. And you would have to go without knowing what the capital of Zambia was. And you couldn't look it up. And you also survived that. I mean, I'm not saying that it's better or worse one or the other way, but this is part of our lives now. And I think there is it's very difficult to go back from there. And I mean, you could potentially say, just leave your phone at home, right? Just don't use your phone or don't have a smartphone.
But and maybe there will be at some point a movement going into this direction, which would be in itself revolutionary again, because at the moment it's unthinkable or almost.
And it's starting, I mean, in the healthcare and bio sector, I mean, it's also starting to measure all your functions. I mean, it measures your steps. I think many, many people do that, knowing I do that, comparing at the end, when you visited in Berlin, at the end of the day, we compare how many steps we did, of course. But also many people measure their sleep quality, and then you have these more
sophisticated stuff like BMI and
stuff,
you know,
measuring weight. Also heart rate, all these things you can do with the phone now. And there are many, of course, and I hope we'll do a episode on digital health soon, where I mean, all these apps that use the phone and use your connection to the phone to do something about your health, be it mental health or be it adherence to drugs or really this idea of digital pills. And again, I mean, this is only facilitated by the availability of the phone and, of course, also by the availability of data. Yeah. But because it's really this handheld device, it really makes this huge change.
And amazing. Yeah.
And there, I think, I mean, this is a technological revolution. I mean, same was, I think, true for steam engine that really changed the way that people worked and made like the more agriculturally based society more into city dwellers and children that had to work 16 hours per day in a factory. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen before. But similarly, I think we're experiencing something that has a profound change at the moment. And the question is the bio-revolution something similar? And I would agree with you, we're not there yet. None of these technologies at the current stage influences our lives that drastically, but they do have the potential to do so.
One quick word about, I was thinking about the attention span and how, you know, our brains are degrading bit by bit.
I don't think that they're degrading. They're just rewiring.
Rewiring.
Yeah. I hope they're not degrading.
One question would be, are we, in a sense, very biased because we're talking class? If you think about less educated people all over the planet who maybe consume tabloids and have been doing so for the past 50, 60, 70 years, or no media at all, or are not informed, or, you know, don't care because they're in a agricultural setting, for instance, and they just, that's their universe, for instance. Maybe they recognize nature and stuff that's going on there, but maybe they're not literate, for instance. And do those folks have an attention span, or is what we're talking about now something that's affecting the educated few?
I do not know what the penetrance all over the world of smartphones is, but I think it's
huge. Yeah.
It's huge.
Yeah,
it's,
absolutely.
I have no statistic on that, but anecdotally, I would feel it's very penetrant. And I think it doesn't really mean, it's not so much about education or about the way that you consume, or it's not about intellectualism. I think it's about attention span and about dopamine hits. And it doesn't really matter if you read the New York Times look at a tree or whatever you do, or it's really about having this quick succession of input that you get from the smartphone. I think this is the change. And this happens, I think, in that affects people quite similarly, I think, irrespective of how they have been communicating before, because it also cuts short the verbal conversation, right? It
Absolutely.
Means that we don't. Yeah. And
you had the example in the trains, or buses,
yeah.
You know. Nobody's
yeah, but also if you have a normal conversation, if you sit with friends, how often does it happen that someone takes out their phone and starts doing something on the phone?
Yeah.
Very often.
True.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is not.
Can we sue those folks who are responsible for that?
But
who are responsible for, I don't name names now, but everybody knows them, of course, but private company having such an impact on the world population, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, but that's the thing, right? This was not planned. And this is what I'm getting at with this technological revolution, because it's something that is, I would say, an unintended consequence. I don't think someone at Apple was sitting around modeling world domination. I think they just thought, oh, this is a really handy thing. I can give that to my customers and they will love it because they loved the iPod before.
Yeah.
And that it really gives this connection hub, I think, between human and technical world. I don't think that they knew what the potential, or, I mean, I have no clue. Maybe they were like,
they did after all.
Maybe they did, yeah. But, and the same again is true. If one of these technologies, be it genetic forecasts, for example, or be it neuroprosthetics, really these implants that Elon Musk's company Neuralink is working on, be it really sophisticated genetic enhancements, or, I mean, and this is talking about human changes, but there's also the other side of green biotech, of transforming. We had this question of artificial microbes. Maybe we can make biomaterials that completely solve the question of climate change, or that give us renewable fuels just by growing some algae in a lab, or lab-grown meat, which is something that
Big development.
Exactly. Yeah. So all these things, and I mean, we don't know what, or currently I would not know what to bet on. I would just bet that one of those has the potential to be the new iPhone or the new steam engine and really drastically change the way we live. Mm-hmm.
And at that point, we would be at the paradigm shift, and then it would be proper to coin the word revolution.
Exactly.
Do you think, which one would you personally pick? I mean, I would fancy stuff is the cyborgism, most definitely, you know, that we're probably or maybe not facing. But there are hints that it's not exponentially, but rapidly developing like corner of the biorevolutionary universe.
Yeah, I would also probably pick that one simply because, but I think it's maybe a little bit uninspired of me to do so because it's the easiest to extrapolate from what everything we just discussed for the phone would be one step further if you have the thing sitting in your brain or mm-hmm. on your retina. But there's, of course, also a lot of other interesting potential of enhancing all kinds of sensory and motor functionalities, like getting supervision mm-hmm. or also having this augmented reality implanted into your life. I mean, I think so far these VR glasses didn't really make it, but
not yet.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but mm-hmm. imagine you could switch on and off on your retina information about the place you're in, for example. Yeah. You would get like, so this building is called that and it was built by this architect right. in
or
the
you
year.
You Google by thinking, exactly. not by, yeah. by punching knobs.
So this one, I think, is kind of a pretty obvious one if it will work. What I find also an interesting concept is this predictiveness that we talked a lot about lately, also, for example, with the polygenic risk scores. This idea that, and I mean, this is the genetic part is only one side of the coin, but there is also many other functions that can predict your health status and that you are forced kind of into a healthy situation by predictive algorithms that constantly give you feedback. I mean, there's on the one hand, of course, your genes, and you could see it. You're born with your genetic horoscope that will predict your life and will tell you, okay, if you do that, something bad will happen. So watch out for fatty foods or whatever it is that might be your downfall. But then at the same time, you might also have a breathalyzer that tells you every morning, you are at a higher risk of developing this disease. You would have a smart toilet that analyzes anything that comes out. And all these constant checkups that give you feedback on your health status, but also give you preventative measures that you could take. And this is something I could foresee. I mean, with all the, or not all the, but these two classes of diabetes drugs that seem to really be candidates for longevity, for example, that at some point everyone
takes them. Yeah, being affected by diabetes or not.
Exactly. And there are, I mean, these ideas around predictiveness and around I'm saying this now very neutrally, not in the sense that I object to everyone being healthier, but it would also be quite a dictate.
One thing also involved here, I think, is that there are huge, gigantic economic cases underlying. I mean, solving the major problems of the healthcare sector. You know, we've been talking about longevity big time in this podcast as well. And some things really might help, you know, to better outcome, to less expensive systems altogether. And when it comes to, I found a little exotic, but at the same time, really revolutionary, your thoughts about solving climate change issues by biological, biorevolutionary new developments. That is really striking as well, I think. So both, but in the moment you have a economic case underlying, you're good to go, I guess.
Yeah, always. And I mean, all these things have a massive, I mean, artificial microbes have the economic case underlying, but similarly, mm-hmm. or any drug that makes you long-term healthier and that you would have to take for the rest of your life, jackpot.
Yeah, of course.
Absolutely. Yeah. And also, of course, all these, I mean, data cases that we have. I mean, if you have an implant in your brain, I would imagine that there is some ad targeting that goes directly into your thoughts. I mean, it will not stop at the blood-brain barrier. There will be, don't you want to buy this?
Yeah. Yeah. And this is, we're doomed, we're saved. This is a little bit doomsday. We didn't talk that in length about the potential involved doom in the revolution for Louis XVI. His life was over in the French Revolution at the end. And
For many, many participants of the revolution as well.
And for Robespierre as well at the end of the day. And many American revolutionaries, many, many, many Russian revolutionaries, of course. In every revolution, there are victims down the road. We pointed out that there sure will be victims here as well. Once we get over the threshold of something being revolutionary to be a full-blown revolution, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, as we discussed now, with the digital revolution or the smartphone revolution, it has a lot of benefits. I mean, we talked more maybe about the negative parts now, but it makes our lives a lot easier, but it also creates new challenges, new problems, new needs. And I think this is also the way that revolutions generally work, is that they solve one problem and open a new one that then needs to be solved.
Let's close easy with a prediction. I mean, when will we reach the state of revolution? I mean, we both agreed that we're right now not in a revolution, though there are revolutionary artifacts, developments that are rapidly developing right now. But the full-blown revolution, when will we have that? The speed of, take AI, is incredible, exponential.
I had to think about exactly that, because there's always this debate.
Yeah. Maybe 3 months
it's
or so.
There's always this debate with all these godfathers of AI when they're asked, like, when will it become conscious? And then some say next year, and others say in 50 years, and some say never.
Yeah,
and then
I know.
Very super opinionated, so I was going to say in 12 years. No, I don't know. Obviously, I don't know. I don't know if ever. I would bet that it's a 20-year horizon. I would think that is realistic from where we stand technologically now. And with the... I'm actually recapitulating accidentally our quote from the beginning, because I think this is kind of true, that there is a lot of volatility and we're very fast suddenly. There has been for a long time, for the last decades, a lot of scientific progress that has had these revolutionary aspects. But we're now in a position where we can do something really with light speed, as we saw for the COVID vaccines. If the need is big enough, we're able to do something very quickly. And we have a number of technological allies, especially AI, that might make these leaps. ChatGPT, before this natural language processing kind of worked. Now we have a tool that can pass all these medical bar whatever exams and just talks to you like a human that has a slightly stinted style. But
are our brains, last quick questions, are our brains equipped with the capability to digest this rapid influx of new things, new information, and new scientific horizons as well?
I think we're having difficulties with this. That said, I think there have always been drastic transformations that also sometimes were pretty fast in human evolution. So I think one of the reasons why we're evolutionary so successful is that we're very adaptable. We can very quickly react to new situations. This makes us very successful as a species. So I think we are generally, from an evolutionary standpoint, capable of reacting to that, or our brains are capable of reacting to that. At the same time, I feel that there is some overwhelm going on currently with many people with the new technologies. Also, when it comes to AI, things are often very simplified into good and evil, kind of, without understanding the complexity, but also the shortcomings and the simplicity of many of these models. And people don't want to make the effort to go one step further to understand it. And I think that's very dangerous. You need to be able to adapt, even though things might be changing, it might be very scary. I think it's important to keep going and be able to be literate in whatever comes your way. And I think many of these things, they're also not so difficult to understand, right? They're complex, but it's possible to integrate them.
very last question. How can you envision your personal role staging the way, the path to being revolutionary to the revolution?
I think, I mean, from an explanatory point of view, that's, I mean, I like to talk about science more than actually doing science nowadays. But I think keeping an eye on what could be the next revolution and talking to other people who might be involved in shaping this future in various roles, I think this is where I see myself. And also being, I am very torn often. I love the excitement around all these technologies. That's why I like to talk about them. Also this kind of crazy potential, like the extinction, for example. Mm-hmm. I have, yeah, this is, it's cool.
The woolly mammoth,
and, mm-hmm. And I also like to read or to talk about the scientists who do that, because I like this mindset of breaking the boundaries and being able to just go where. And I think this is also what motivates this biorevolution, is that we don't want to obey by the rules of biology. We want to transcend that. We want to make our own code and do things differently. And this is absolutely fascinating. I love that. But at the same time, of course, I can see that there is, with any research that involves the human biology, but also the biology of the planet, of course, the potential to do a lot of bad, not necessarily intentionally, of course, also intentionally, but also with unintended consequences. There is a lot of stuff that can go wrong. And while being excited, also thinking about that, I think is quite important.
Any idea what we're going to do next time?
I think we might revisit the large language models and talk about what...
We should, most definitely.
Talk about ChatGPT one more time, or it's not ChatGPT alone anymore and all the other models. But I think we talked about it like roughly a year ago, and then we had a lot of predictions. And I think having a look how those played out could be very interesting.
In AI times, a year is a century. So for a good reason, we talk about that, maybe integrating some life experiments then.
Exactly.
We could do that.
Yeah.
We're Doomed, We're Saved, episode 23. Thanks for listening. You find We're Doomed, We're Saved everywhere where you find good podcasts. And if you want to get in touch with us, please do so at sciencetales.com. And we would appreciate your ideas, your feedback, and also topics we might talk about and discuss in this podcast. Thanks for listening.